Sangye chutang so ki cho nam la Chang chu bar du da mi kya su chi Da gi jin so gi bi so nam gi Dro la pin ju sangye du par shu I go for refuge until I am enlightened. The Buddha, Siddhartha, and the Assembly of Saints. By the practice of giving and the other perfections, we attain the state of Buddha, to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened. The Buddha, Siddhartha, and the Assembly of Saints. From the virtuous merits that I collect by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of Buddha, to benefit all sentient beings. May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings never be separated from the bliss which is sorrowless. May all dwell in equanimity, free from aversion and clinging. Ground is covered with flowers and sprinkled with scented water. In the middle is Mount Meru, surrounded by the four continents, ornamented by the sun and the moon. By visualizing all this and offering it as a Buddha mount, may all sentient beings partake of the Buddha's pure land. Om Guru Buddha Bodhisattva Saparivara Ratnamanda Buddha Mega Samudra Saparana Samayi. Okay, welcome. Sakya Pandita's clarifying the sage's intent. So let's just take a moment to recap where we've come from and where we are. We're working our way through Sakya Pandita's comments on the six perfections. And we have arrived at diligence, or what I prefer to call joyous enthusiasm. But it's generally in the text referred to as diligence. And we've talked about the definition of it and the antidote to the cause and antidote to the result. The big enemy of diligence is laziness in all its various forms that we've discussed. Not just lying around, but also being too busy, among other things. We have arrived at the antidote to the result. Ape Rinpoche's commentary on that says, the most effective immediate antidote for overcoming laziness is to reflect again and again on impermanence. When we are strongly attached to this life, there is no possibility of maturing our minds in order to carry out genuine spirituality. We cannot turn our minds away from worldliness, and hence cannot bring benefit even to ourselves. One who truly wants to practice Dharma must feel aversion towards this life's aims and ambitions. By way of illustration, it is said that there was a Kadampa monk who thought he was practicing Dharma very diligently. One day, while he was circumambulating a temple, a great teacher by the name of Geshe Thompa approached him and remarked that while performing circumambulations was excellent, it would really be better for him to practice Dharma. The Kadampa monk thought to himself, studying the scriptures must surely count as practicing Dharma, so he started studying the scriptures. Geshe Thompa again came up to him and said that while he was doing an excellent practice, but that it would be better still to practice Dharma. The monk thought that meditating might be the way to practice Dharma, so he embarked on the practice of meditation with great enthusiasm. Again, Gajitompa came to him and said that while practicing meditation was indeed excellent, would it not be better if he practiced Dharma? Hearing this again, the Kadampa monk asked him how Dharma should be practiced. And Gajitompa replied that the way to practice Dharma was to give up attachment to this life. When we think about how Dharma must be practiced, it may be likened to a meeting. If we call a meeting of many people and the chairperson fails to show up, the meeting would be unsuccessful. Likewise, while one is practicing, there are indeed many virtuous thoughts in the mind, but if the understanding of the impermanence of this life is not present, our practice will be unsuccessful. While we are totally engaged in worldly activities, our mind is attached to the 8 worldly dharmas, or what I like to call the 4 poisonous dichotomies. The 8 worldly dharmas being gain and loss, fame and disgrace, praise and blame, and pleasure and misery. No matter what deeds we perform, they cannot be virtuous deeds if we are attached to the 8 worldly dharmas. Of course, as long as we remain within samsara, it's impossible for us to abandon these 8 worldly dharmas completely. Nevertheless, if we perform deeds with the understanding of the need to reduce or abandon our attachment to these 8, we are entering the dharma. It is pure folly to be attached to this life, thinking that it is permanent. We should see that this life is short and have no idea when we will leave it. By being attached to it, we're only creating obstacles for ourselves. Take as an example someone embarked on a long journey who, after having traveled for quite a while, decides to stop and rest. If they were to build an entire house to rest in, that would be a mistake, because they still have a long way to go. Similarly, if we worked just for this life alone, it would be akin to stopping and building a house we don't need, as we will soon be leaving it. Therefore, it's a grave error not to keep in mind the impermanence of this life, and it is futile to work for the sake of this life alone. So that is what's called purifying the objects of experience. And now we're going to go into the section called purifying the spheres of activity. Ape Rinpoche continues saying, enthusiasm itself is the remedy for laziness. There are 2 aspects to this. 1, purifying the spheres of activity, and 2, practicing excellence. First, purifying the spheres of activity. Purifying the spheres of activity means that in addition to adopting virtuous deeds and refraining from non-virtuous deeds, we should transform all our neutral actions into virtuous deeds. I just want to say a personal note at this point. This type of activity that we're going to hear about now, this type of practice, well, first of all, it was the first Dharma teaching I ever received from Geshe Taji Namgyo. It has a sort of important place in my heart. But also, I think, personally, this practice is a little bit underestimated, because most of our day is spent in neutral activities. It's not spent so much in non-virtue or virtue, but we spend a lot of time just living our life, eating, buying groceries, walking, driving our car, doing our taxes, and all these things that are considered neutral. of course, everybody's challenged with time, not having enough time for this and that, and our practice is one of those things that is subject to time constraints. But if we really think about what is really the game here, the Mahayana practice is to accumulate merit in order to realize wisdom. And that's really it in a nutshell. If we really have a short life and a precious human rebirth, which we do, then it becomes skillful means to take advantage of these practices which allow us to change all these neutral activities that we have during the day into virtuous activities. Now, for a Vajrayana practitioner, it's relatively easy because we have lots of mantras we can say. But not everybody has that proclivity. So this is another way of practicing which is very simple, very easy. And not only does it convert the neutral activity into a virtuous activity, but it helps to stop our mind from going into the negative side of things, because we're busy doing virtue. It actually distracts us, so to speak, from non-virtue. That's my little preamble to this type of practice. So now what we're going to hear from Api Rinpoche is a lot of examples about how we could do this, with the idea that we get an understanding of it that we can then invent our own way of doing it. It's not like you have to do his way, but it's just to show you the model, so to speak, and then encouraging us to adapt it to our own particular situation, or as Ram Dass says, our karmic predicament. Here are some examples from Api Rinpoche. Oh, and one more comment. These are aspirations, and it's important to remember that aspirations are a really important type of practice. They're like planting seeds that ripen later. So what we're doing is we're planting the seeds for what we hope to accomplish when we become enlightened. So, when sitting at home, a bodhisattva should form the resolution, may I reach the city of liberation. And likewise, when going to sleep, they should resolve, may I attain the Dharmakaya of Buddhahood. And if they dream, may I realize that every phenomenon is like a dream. When waking up, may I awaken from ignorance. When rising, may I attain the form body of Buddhahood. When dressing, may I put on the robe of self-respect and shame. When tying up one's belt, may my mind be connected to the roots of merit. When sitting on a mat, may I attain the adamantine seat at the stage of awakening. When resting one's back against something, may I arrive at the tree under which awakening is attained. When lighting a fire, may the defilements be burned up. When the fire is burning, may the fire of transcendental wisdom blaze forth. When food is being prepared, may I attain the ambrosia of transcendental wisdom. When eating, may I acquire the food of meditative concentration. So I'm just going to make a note about that. The Buddha set out guidelines of what are proper offerings and what are not. Because there are some other practices that involve human sacrifice or animal sacrifice, and so the Buddha didn't want that. So he set out what you could and couldn't offer. So, for example, food or incense or water or music, those are some of the offerings. And the offering of food, which a lot of us do here at the center here, we bring food offerings and put them on the altar. What are the karmic results of that? Well, on the sort of relative level, it means that you will have enough food, enough for your practice. You won't go hungry. You will have your needs met so that you can practice. But on a higher level, the karmic result of a food offering is success at meditation. I think it's good to know that when we make a food offering, we have these benefits that come from it. So that's why I believe Apa Rinpoche said here, when eating, may I acquire the food of meditative concentration. Rinpoche continues, when going outside, may I escape from the city of cyclic existence. When going downstairs, may I enter into cyclic existence for the benefit of sentient beings. When opening a door, may the gate to the city of liberation be opened. When closing a door, may the door to the three miserable destinies be shut. He means the three lower realms. When embarking on a path, may I enter upon the noble path. When going uphill, may sentient beings be established in the happiness of the higher destinies. When going downhill, may the continuum of the three lower destinies be broken. So there are literally pages of these examples in these texts and the commentaries. I won't read all of them now, but just to give you a taste, and maybe as we go along we'll read some more of these examples just to have the flavor of it from these masters. So now we go into a section called Purifying the Complete Achievement. This is all in regard to diligence, of course. So His Holiness the 42nd Sakya Treason says, the antidote to the result is of two kinds, purifying the objects of experience and perfectly complete achievement. Purifying the objects of experience means that all of our experiences should be transformed into virtuous deeds, since neutral deeds can become either virtuous or non-virtuous depending on our motivation. We should take care to transform them into virtuous ones. For example, while at home, the bodhisattva should think, may all beings gain the great liberation from the whole of samsara. And when we sleep, we should think, may all beings gain the dharmakaya. And in the context of the training related to the refuge vow, it was mentioned that upon waking, we should have the divine pride of the form body of Buddhahood. This does not mean that we should think of ourselves as real Buddhas, but instead we should think, may all beings attain the form body of the Buddha. In this way, our actions will not be meaningless, and every deed will become purposeful and the cause for attaining Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings. Then, for the perfectly complete achievement of our practice of diligence, all of our actions must either directly or indirectly benefit others. In other words, we should avoid actions that do not achieve this. Directly benefiting others includes teaching the Dharma and giving beneficial material gifts to others. Of the two purposes for self and others, bodhisattvas mainly accomplish the purpose of others, which indirectly accomplishes their own purpose. In this way, it's important to study Shantideva's Entering the Bodhisattva's Path, plus the teachings of Clarifying the Sage's Intent, and Parting from the Four Attachments, and to implement the meaning of these mind training texts, then dedicating the merit of such study. Then our practice will become a complete practice. And when we engage in actions to gain wealth in the future, these actions can benefit others indirectly. In the same way, when we give the gift of the Dharma by teaching others, we benefit them directly. Through our study of the Dharma now, we will be able to share the teachings in the future. In this way, our studies benefit others indirectly. We should therefore carry out our studies, and indeed all virtuous actions, with the right motivation, which is to benefit others, and dedicate our deeds to become direct or indirect causes for attaining Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings. And now we go to the section called Correctly Accomplishing Diligence. And His Holiness continues by saying, as with the previous perfections, correctly accomplishing diligence has two aspects: achieving the four excellent qualities and eliminating the seven attachments. The first quality that our practice of diligence must possess is that it should be free from laziness. Secondly, our actions should be sealed with wisdom that realizes selflessness, which in this text, meaning Sakyapandita's text, it's called the non-discursive, the absence of a substantial self. The third is perfectly fulfilling all the wishes of others by benefiting them through our own diligence. And finally, the fourth quality is, through our diligence, maturing sentient beings by establishing them in one of the three vehicles, whichever is their goal. Here, we are not differentiating between temporary and ultimate goals because the distinction between these three goals is a temporary one. Ultimately, there is only one goal, which is perfect Buddhahood. As for eliminating the seven attachments, the first one is attachment to laziness, such as attachment to sleeping. The second is attachment to procrastination, which means delaying joyful, diligent engagement in virtuous deeds. The third is premature satisfaction, which means, for example, not wanting to put further effort into gaining knowledge by studying the Dharma after the initial spurt of joyful enthusiasm. To become a great scholar, in addition to intelligence, we need consistent diligence and for our knowledge to benefit others. And so we need to practice moral conduct with the right motivation, diligence, and good understanding. The fourth attachment is the hope of getting something in return in the future. For example, diligently studying the Buddha Dharma, thinking that in the future we can gain a good livelihood based on our knowledge. The fifth is attachment to the future result of a deed, for example, gaining knowledge of the Dharma to obtain a higher rebirth in our next life and to avoid being born in the three lower realms. The sixth is attachment to the propensities opposed to diligence. This refers to the tendency for laziness that has not yet been destroyed, which can also harm our own happiness as well as the happiness of others. And lastly, the seventh attachment is the two types of distraction, as explained in the chapter on generosity, which are the distraction of attention and the distraction of conceptual thinking. And if you remember, the distraction of conceptual thinking means clinging to the three spheres. What are the three spheres? The doer, the receiver, and the action, thinking that they are permanent, solid, independently existent, which they're not, of course. These four and these seven are given for each of the six perfections, if you've noticed as we go along. So that is correctly accomplishing diligence. Ape Rinpoche says about this topic, when we practice virtue, we must be in a happy mood and enjoy what we do. Otherwise, we will not be able to accomplish virtuous deeds. Even when it comes to worldly matters such as professional work, we won't be effective unless we are happy in our work. We will be miserable, not to mention the effect we will have on the people around us. However, if we enjoy what we do, we can succeed. Likewise, if we undertake study or a meditation retreat with a happy mind, we will be successful. As explained earlier, when practicing the perfection of enthusiasm or joyous effort, we must conjoin it with the four positive qualities and abandon the seven attachments. The practice of the perfection of enthusiasm is also crucial to those following the Vajrayana path. And I think we mentioned last time, it's crucial for any path that you're doing. If you don't have enthusiasm for it, won't get very far. Okay, so what are the benefits of practicing diligence? His Holiness the 42nd Sakyatrizin says, the benefits of undertaking diligence are of two types. The temporary benefits that we gain in this and future lives, and the ultimate benefits. In this life, all mundane activities can be accomplished through diligent effort, and the same is true in particular regarding Dharma activities accomplished through the perfection of diligence. As a result, we can gain excellent qualities, wealth, and followers, though the latter two are not our intended aims. If we gain these as byproducts of our practice, there is no fault. With good motivation, we can use these resources to lead others to liberation and enlightenment. At the time of death, we will feel no remorse because we have done our best to lead a meaningful life. We will also not be overwhelmed by fear, knowing that our consistent Dharma practice will be our guide, protector, and savior. No matter how much wealth we have, how powerful or famous we are, no matter how many close family members and friends we have, none of these will help us escape death or gain a higher rebirth, nor can we take any of these with us to the next life. Our dear ones and our possessions will not reduce the suffering we experience at the time of death. But our attachment to them will make the transition very difficult for us. We must remember that we will leave everything behind, including our most prized possession, our body. Eventually, it will be disposed of in one way or another. Only our actions will go with us, determining where we will be reborn, whether we will have a good life or not. They will follow us like a shadow in our mind stream. Therefore, we must realize how important it is to practice the Dharma. When we speak of Dharma practice, we are not referring only to our physical or verbal practice. It is mainly our mental practice, taming our mind, making a positive impact on our mind, that allows us to improve ourselves, to become a better person, and to develop good qualities. In brief, the benefits of our practice of diligence are that in this life, we can live happily, and we won't have regrets or fear at the time of death. Shanti Deva says that the precious human body is like a boat. We need to cross the ocean of samsara. And just as we would look after the boat to cross the ocean, but leave it behind once we have reached the shore, we should look after this body well and use it in order to attain Buddhahood, but not be attached to it. The benefits of diligence for our future lives are that we will have good results life after life, with positive qualities always increasing as we progress on the path. And eventually, we will obtain the inconceivable wisdom of the state of Buddhahood as the ultimate benefit of diligence. As one of the six perfections, it is a cause for the attainment of Buddhahood, which brings such ultimate qualities as the 10 powers, the 4 fearlessnesses, great compassion, and the ultimate power to benefit sentient beings. Now, all these qualities, the powers, and so on and so forth, we will go into in detail when we get to the chapter on Buddhahood. So they keep whetting our appetite here as we go along. They keep mentioning them. As far as the benefits of diligence that Aparimshe talks about, he says, there are great benefits to be gained from practicing enthusiasm. In this lifetime alone, we will be able to accomplish all the worldly and spiritual activities. We will attract followers, wealth, and marvelous qualities. And by obtaining wealth and acquisitions in harmony with spirituality, we will be happy in the present life and have no regrets when we die. Neither humans nor non-humans will be able to obstruct our Dharma practice. We will gain knowledge and wisdom even in this lifetime. With regard to benefits in future lives, we will be able to relinquish non-virtuous thoughts and accomplish virtuous thoughts in a short period of time. So, we can see that all the purities and all the accomplishments arise from enthusiasm. Thus, enthusiasm is the very source of accomplishing both worldly and supramundane qualities. Without enthusiasm, it would be impossible to gain these qualities, just as movement would be impossible without the presence of the wind element. Therefore, the practice of enthusiasm is indispensable. And with regard to the ultimate result, the qualities resulting from the practice of enthusiasm at the stage of Buddhahood are the 10 powers, the 4 kinds of fearlessness, and so on, and Buddha's activities for the sake of sentient beings, which are accomplished without obstruction. That concludes the practice of diligence. Do we have any questions about diligence? Okay. Well then, we have a little bit more time here. Let's carry on to the next chapter, which is chapter 8, the perfection of meditative concentration. The last 2 perfections, meditative concentration and wisdom, are both very thick chapters, big topics. But these perfections, I think you can see, they're leading up in this direction. You know, we started with generosity and we're working our way up. The 6th perfection of wisdom is, in a way, is the big goal. And it cannot be accomplished by any other means except meditation. And in order to accomplish meditation, we need a lot of merit, which is what we have gained through the practice of the previous perfections. Of course, the practice of meditation is also a merit generator. And in order to accomplish wisdom, we need a lot of merit. So we need a lot of merit, and we need to know how to meditate. So these next two chapters are really important to understand and to practice well. So that's one of the reasons that there's an extensive discussion of these two topics. As usual, Sakyapandita introduces the topic saying, well, we need to know the definition, we need to ascertain the nature, and we need to know the benefits. So we'll go through those in order, starting with His Holiness the 42nd Sakyatrizin, who says in Chapter 8, The Perfection of Meditative Concentration, the explanation of the fifth perfection, the perfection of meditative concentration, also has three main topics: the definition, ascertaining the nature, and the benefits of realizing meditative concentration. The definition of meditative concentration, according to the Mahayana tradition, the definition is, quote, placing the mind in calmed focus for the sake of attaining complete Buddhahood, unquote. And as with the previous perfections, it becomes the perfection of meditative concentration when it's endowed with proper preparation of enlightenment thought, the right actual practice, and the conclusion. Ascertaining the nature of meditative concentration also has three parts. Identifying the antithesis of meditative concentration, discerning the individual antidotes, and correctly accomplishing meditative concentration. Identifying the antithesis of meditative concentration. First, we must identify distraction and reflect on its harmful consequences. Distraction refers to a mind that is not able to focus single-pointedly on the intended object. This includes mundane objects as well as virtuous objects when they are not the objects of focus at that particular moment. For example, if during our study session of clarifying the sage's intent, we focus on other things, even virtuous practices like reciting refuge or other prayers, we are being distracted. Although we sometimes need to make plans and think ahead, focusing on the future all the time jeopardizes the outcome of our present action. We should therefore focus with great attention on the current right object and leave our planning of future activities for a time which is dedicated to that. Although we may be intelligent, without concentration, we cannot study properly and gain knowledge. Concentration is therefore very important to properly carry out any virtuous action. We need concentration for mundane activities. Driving a car without concentration, for instance, can have severe consequences. Distraction has harmful consequences in this life and causes the destruction of happiness in all of our future lives. As Shantideva said, a person whose mind is distracted dwells between the fangs of mental afflictions. This means that due to distraction, our afflictions, such as hatred and attachment, will increase, creating suffering and problems for ourselves and others in this life. Regarding it destroying happiness in all future lives, once the mind is used to being distracted, it's not easy to appease it without great effort. We should therefore learn to tame our minds as soon as possible. Otherwise, there will be no end to samsara and the suffering we experience. A habitually distracted mind is like a waterfall falling from a precipice. It is almost impossible to reverse. Therefore, as soon as we notice any distraction, we must determine not to become habituated to it. Otherwise, we won't achieve any great results in life. To achieve such results, however, meditative concentration alone is not sufficient. We also need to understand the proper process involved in the practice of meditation. The general structure we need to follow was mentioned earlier. Based on pure moral conduct, we engage in study, contemplation, and meditation. Without knowledge, we cannot meditate properly. However, these four alone do not constitute the complete practice. Performing them with the wrong motivation is the seed of the lower realms rather than Buddhahood. Therefore, having the right motivation is very important for the practice of meditation as well. Now, discerning the individual antidotes, this has two parts: the antidote to the causes of distraction and the antidote to the result. The antidote to the causes of distraction has two aspects: ridding itself of attachments and calling to mind the virtues of solitude. First, ridding the mind of attachments. The cause of distraction is attachment to particular people and to our possessions. We must therefore begin by letting go of our attachment to these. It is said that having strong attachment prevents us from seeing the reality of the relative and the ultimate truth, and it can destroy the thought of renunciation and the wish to gain liberation. The reality is that we will part ways with all those we love, whether in a few years or at the end of our life. And even though we might believe that our attachment to them is not harmful, we will suffer greatly when it is time to separate. This attachment might also generate anger and jealousy in relation to someone we love, prompting us to engage in many negative actions to maintain the relationship. This relationship itself, however, may last for several decades at best, but the negative actions we will have committed in relation to it will remain with us for a long time after it has ended, until they produce their results, ripening either in this life or in future lives. When we first meet someone, minor incidents can produce a friendship. Likewise, small factors can later cause separation. As ordinary human beings, we have many negative thoughts. We're jealous of those who are superior to us in terms of knowledge, power, wealth, background, and even experience in the Dharma. We're competitive with those we consider our equals, and we look down on those we perceive as inferior. And in this way, we develop jealousy, anger, and pride, and we are unable to bear criticism. Not only are the mundane friendships we make not the cause of genuine happiness, higher rebirth, or Buddhahood, the negative actions we perform out of our strong attachment to others, sometimes even if we don't know them personally, it may lead us to the lower realms. The second type of attachment to be let go of is our attachment to possessions. The process of accumulating wealth through mundane means is often connected with negative deeds, actions that are not in accordance with the Dharma. These include not caring about the wrong we do, the suffering we cause, or the ill repute we may gain as a result. Accumulating wealth in this way can also cause quarrels with perceived enemies and therefore cause disharmony in society. Disharmony emerges within families, with friends, and with strangers alike. To gain wealth, some people lie, deceive, and harm others, disregarding their welfare and well-being, just thinking of their own selfish gains. The resultant physical, verbal, and mental negative actions are all based on this selfish intention. In this way, wealth is stained in the beginning by the negative actions we commit to accumulate it. Then, once we have gained some wealth, we suffer again, wanting to protect it and worrying about not earning more. And even if we do accumulate more, we worry about losing it or having it stolen through deception or other means. And in the end, we suffer when we lose our wealth, whether due to our lack of merit through our own fault or that of our relatives, our partners, or because it's taken from us by force. Many problems, disputes, and court cases between partners, between siblings, between parents and their children center around wealth. In brief, to earn money, we engage in many negative actions. Once we have it, unless it is used in the right way, it's the basis for many conflicts and much suffering. And in the end, we suffer from losing it. And in this way, wealth can be a great source of suffering and trouble. Those who do not possess great wealth do not face this kind of difficulty, although, of course, they have other causes of suffering. Shanti Davis says, because of the torments of collecting, guarding, and losing it, desirous people have this and many other disadvantages, but little profit. Shantideva gives the analogy of an animal forced to pull a heavy chariot and suffering enormous hardships only to be rewarded with a mouthful of grass. We should also consider the severe future consequences of the negative deeds committed due to our attachment to wealth. In his commentary on parting from the four attachments, Sakyapandita explains the faults of samsara, saying that enjoying the pleasures of samsara, such as wealth, is like enjoying eating a tasty but poisonous fruit. Eating it may give us a few moments of pleasure, but it will also cause a lot of pain or even our death. Similarly, as ordinary human beings who are under the control of mental afflictions and perform negative actions, enjoying the five sense pleasures can bring brief satisfaction. But, as a result of our attachment, we may be born in the lower realms, where we will experience inconceivable suffering for an unimaginably long period of time. In summary, these are some of the faults of being attached to possessions. Our attachment is the cause of suffering, not happiness, and we should therefore rid ourselves of it. Ape Rinpoche says about this, with regard to overcoming the causes of a distracted mind, we must first identify them. Basically, our mind becomes distracted because of desirous attachment, especially to other beings and to wealth. In order to overcome actual distraction, we must abandon such attachment. It's obvious that there are many faults associated with being attached to others. First of all, attachment obstructs us from understanding the sufferings of worldly existence. And if we fail to realize that worldly existence is a state of suffering, we won't wish to renounce it. And if we've become attached to others, we will suffer when we have to part from them. And furthermore, we will fall under their influence. Then instead of using our precious human rebirth, attained with such difficulty, for a worthwhile purpose, we will waste our life trying to satisfy the short-term worldly desires of others. This becomes a serious obstacle to attaining the state of enlightenment. And furthermore, the people of this world are very hard to please. They become either happy or unhappy over trifling matters. At certain times they befriend us, and at other times they turn into our enemies. And when we do nice things for people with the thought of pleasing them, they may become displeased instead. They may even become angry and hate us for it. From all angles, it's extremely difficult to please others. There are many problems in dealing with human beings. Those at a lower level become jealous. Those at the same level try to compete with us. And those in a higher position look down on us, arrogantly. If we praise people, they become proud. If we criticize them, they become resentful. Regardless of our relationships with others and irrespective of what we do to help them, we cannot be of any benefit to them at all. It's said that a wealthy person is criticized for what he has, and a poor person is criticized for having nothing. In other words, everybody will be criticized regardless of their position in life. In one sutra, Buddha stated that all the inhabitants of this world are concerned only about their own benefit. This being the case, there is no one in this world we can regard as a real friend. We cannot place any reliance on the people of this world. If we are powerful, people will listen to us and respect us regardless of what we say, either because they fear us or because they hope to gain some advantage. But once we lose our power, people won't listen to us anymore. However inspiring our speech, and however many favors we may have done for them in the past, in fact, they'll criticize us. And when we are wealthy, there will be lots of friends hanging around, pleased to do whatever they can for us. But when we lose our wealth, they will turn away from us, and we may never see their faces again. Buddha mentioned that although the Buddha's teachings are perfect in every way, some people nevertheless criticize them. And even the Buddha himself was criticized during his time on earth. So if we think we can please everybody and hope that they will like us and look up to us, we are making a big mistake. We will never be able to satisfy the myriad people in this world, all of whom are constantly seeking different things. At one time, the Buddha's cousin, Devadatta, who was also considered by ordinary people to be the Buddha's great enemy, became ill and was nearing death. Buddha went to bless him, and he recovered. But when Devadatta was well again, he showed great disrespect towards Buddha by telling him that the only reason he had been able to help him was that he was a capable doctor, and added that because of his medical skills, he would have no problem feeding himself in his old age. And also during the time of the Buddha, there was a man by the name of Lekpe Karma, who told Buddha that a Jain master had gained the state of omniscience, and that he was the only person in the world who possessed that quality. Buddha told Lekpe Karma that the Jain master would die of indigestion in 7 days. Lekpe Karma went back to the Jain master and told him what Buddha had said. He advised the master to eat very little through the next 7 days, and that way he could prove the Buddha to be wrong. So the Jain master ate almost no food for 6 days. However, he miscalculated and thought that the next day, which was actually the seventh day, was the eighth day. So he ate a good meal and died of indigestion on the seventh day. He was reborn as a hungry ghost. In the form of this hungry ghost rebirth, the Jain master met Lekpe Karma and told him that the Buddha had been correct. Buddha was the real omniscient one, he said, and Lekpe Karma should give up his disbelief in the Buddha, seek his blessings, and take refuge in him. Nevertheless, Lekpe Karma did not like this idea, and he did not develop faith in the Buddha. In fact, when he met the Buddha later on, he told him that he had been wrong to say that the Jain master would die, because the Jain master had not died. And Buddha replied, "Not only did your teacher, the Jain master, die within 7 days, but he has actually spoken to you in the form of his rebirth as a hungry ghost." And Lekpe Karma retorted that the Buddha was mistaken about the Jain master having been reborn as a hungry ghost, because he had actually been reborn in one of the heavenly realms. And the Buddha asked, "Well, then who was that hungry ghost you were talking to, who told you to come and see me and to have faith in me?" At that point, Lekpe Karma realized that the Buddha really had omniscience, and he became highly embarrassed and ashamed about having tried to trick him. Nevertheless, although he now understood that Buddha had the quality of omniscience and could see the future and the state of other beings, he still did not develop faith in him. And even though he saw the power of Buddha, he just walked away. This account shows that although Buddha is completely omniscient and perfectly enlightened, even he cannot satisfy every living being. Furthermore, Buddha said that we should not be attached even to our loved ones, such as parents or close relatives, because eventually we'll have to part from them. And when we exit this life, we will be on our own. No one can help us, not even those who have helped us during this lifetime. And furthermore, it's not appropriate to hate our enemies, because everybody is always changing. Even friends and loved ones can become enemies during this life, not to mention future lives. And here's a story to illustrate this point. There was a couple who had a daughter. The husband later was reborn as a fish, and the wife was reborn as a dog. And at one time, the daughter was sitting by the roadside, eating a fish with her baby on her lap. And while she was eating, a dog tried to get the bone from her. She beat and kicked the dog as she sat holding the baby, munching the fish, and driving the dog away. An arhat passed. Looking at them through his clairvoyance, he shook his head and murmured to himself that the world was a very strange place indeed. The woman was eating her father, beating her mother, and sitting with her enemy resting on her lap. And thus, we can see how futile it is to become attached to others. As I said, this is an extensive chapter, so we'll stop there. Are there any questions about meditative concentration or any of this that we've talked about so far? Okay, well, in that case, we'll complete our circle here with our dedication. So, Nam De Tam Jazi Pani Top Nani Pedanam Pam Jiti Ki Gana Ji Balung Tu Pe Si Pe So Le No Andru Arsho Jang Chuk Sim Cho Grim Po Che Ma Ke Pa Nam Ke Gyur Chik Ke Ma Nyam Par Me Par Yang Gong Ne Gong Tu Pil Par Sho Jump up, O Jitar Ken. Sangbo De Yung De Jin De De Da Kung Ge Je Su Da Lo Che Ge Wa Di Da Tam Che Ra Du Mu Tu Zung Je Bi Gya Wa Tam Che Ki Nga Gang La Cho Tu Nga Pa Gi Da Shen Ge We Sa Wa Di Kun Kyang Sang Po Chu Chi Ra Tu No Wa Gi Cha Sa Wa Dang Cho Ching Sha Pa Dang Yesu yi rong gu xin so wa yi Ge wa chung zhe da ki chi san pa Tam che zo pe jang chu chi By this merit may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing.
From the stormy
waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death,
from the ocean of samsara, may all beings be free. Bodhicitta is precious. May it arise in all beings in whom it has not arisen.
May it never decline where it has arisen, but may it ever grow and flourish. In whatever way valiant Manjushri and Samantabhadra know how to transfer merit, so do I dedicate all my own virtues that I may train to be like them. Through this dedication, praise the Supreme, by the victorious Buddhas of the past, present, and future, I, together with all sentient beings, dedicate these roots of virtue to attaining Buddhahood. May whatever little virtue I may have gained by prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, requesting, and beseeching, be dedicated to attaining perfect enlightenment. Thank you.
Thank you.